Welcome, everyone, to the Battle of Gettysburg podcast. I am your co-host. There you go. I am your co-host, Eric Lindblade, and as always, I am joined by my co-host, Jim Hessler. Jim?
Well, thank you.
Jim, tell everyone where we're coming from tonight.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm choked up for a minute by that spontaneous show of affection. Thank you. Yeah, thanks, everybody. Welcome to a very special night here at the new Adams County Historical Society. Of which we have been longtime supporters long before it became socially cool to do so. I'll just kind of point that out. But, you know, for a long while, what are we in? Are we in season four, Eric? Where are we now? Season four. You know, Eric and I have been realizing for a while that we were going to need to do something on Lincoln and the Gettysburg Address. So we've been kind of shuffling that around here a little bit. And then every time I bump into Tim at the Farnsworth House, we occasionally talk about, hey, Tim, when are we going to have you on the show? So we kind of thought tonight we would kind of cross two of these items off the bucket list. We're going to do Lincoln at Gettysburg and welcoming Tim Smith to his very first appearance on the Battle of Gettysburg podcast. So here we are before a standing room only crowd at the ACHS. But before we get to our special guest, how about a nice round of applause as I turn it over to Superfan Jody from Savage.
Thank you, everyone. I have the honor of introducing another native Marylander. That's important. Had to throw that in there. Tim Smith. Tim is the historian here at the Adams County Historical Society and the official historian of Adams County. That's a pretty major deal, right? And tonight we're chatting with him about 25 very special hours here in Gettysburg back in November of 1863.
Well, thank you. I'm really happy to be here. I think one of the reasons probably that it's interesting, you know, as a topic for me is the fact that, you know, maybe there were 15 or 20,000 people that attended Abraham Lincoln's Gettysburg Address, and a lot of the outsiders had to come in by train. So I've always thought that most of the people that heard Lincoln deliver the address that day had to have been locals that walked here or came in by carriage or wagon. And quite possibly, more than two-thirds of the people that heard the Gettysburg Address were actually from here. So, you know, I've studied how the people who lived here viewed the Gettysburg Address and what it meant to them and what kind of experience it was and how Lincoln spent his time here. So that's kind of where I'm coming from when I study the Gettysburg Address. I don't study, like, the meaning of the words and whether this statement came from the ancient Greeks or Romans.
I think that's Pericles. So.
A lot of people, I guess what I'm saying is there's nothing wrong with that, but a lot of people study the Gettysburg Address as a national event, and I've kind of studied it as a local event.
All right. You literally just killed my first question. So that was very good. Yeah, good job. Good opening.
Yes, they're cheering our show going downhill as we speak. This exactly. is magnificent. So
you know, this is your first appearance with us. Before I forget, I'd be remiss if I didn't point out that Gary is a hugely acknowledged public fan of the program.
So, Superfan Gary, in fact.
Gary, yeah. So I'm sure Gary will be, I'm sure, listening to this at some point.
And I would say that Gary has told me like four or five times, you should go on that show. You haven't been on that show yet. So he has repeatedly insisted I be a guest.
What we were talking about this before we went on. Was it Gary who coined the phrase local crap?
Yes.
I thought that was yes.
So this will be lots of local crap.
So we're gonna so we'll do more local and less the meaning of the address and all of that stuff.
You know, that's kind of what I'm about, I guess.
Okay. Well, 25 hours in Gettysburg. If you don't have Tim's article, 2008 edition of Blue and Gray, it's a fantastic article. Every time I say to Tim, Tim, what book would you recommend on this? He always says, go to my blue and gray article, sort of thing. So I picked up a copy at some point. But you want to start by just kind of walking the listeners through then these 25 hours, starting with how and why Amistad comes to Gettysburg?
Well, you know, obviously Lincoln came to Gettysburg to make an important speech. And I think I just, to flash back for just a second, the Gettysburg Address was something that Lincoln had been wanting to say for a long time. And there, after Lincoln receives word that the Union Army is victorious at Gettysburg, he makes a speech outside the White House. And it's recorded in some of the newspapers. And if you read that speech, there's a lot of things in that speech that are paraphrasing what he would later say in the Gettysburg Address. So these are thoughts that he had had for a long time. And he caught wind of the fact that there was going to be a dedication ceremony around the Soldiers' National Cemetery. And, you know, how exactly it happened is a little bit debated, but it seems like Curtin was in Washington, D.C., and Abraham Lincoln mentioned that he might come to the dedication ceremony. So when Governor Curtin got back to Harrisburg, he telegraphed David Wills, who was the local agent for Curtin in the establishment of the Soldiers' National Cemetery. And then Curtin wrote a personal invitation to Abraham Lincoln. Now, that invitation was sent on November 2nd. I mean, think about that, November 2nd, and the ceremony is on November 19th. Of course, Curtin also, I should say, Wills, also sent a message saying, hey, you can stay at my house if you like also. So he did, Lincoln accepted, and of course, Lincoln left Washington, D.C., on November 18th, about noon, pulled into the Gettysburg Station later that evening, spent a night in Gettysburg on November 18th, and put the finishing touches on, and delivered the next day, you know, probably the greatest speech in American history. Now, at some point when I was researching the story, I came across the fact that his train pulled in the station about 6 p.m. Some accounts say 6:30, but I have to have it at 6 for my title to work. And the next day, he left at 7 p.m. That's pretty good that he left at 7. So I said, wow, that's 25 hours. So I coined that term, and I have tried to push it as much as I can. And so anytime you hear this 25 hours at Gettysburg instead of 24 hours, then you know I've had some influence on that person delivering.
Are you saying somebody stole your theory on
no,
that?
No,
is
no.
that what you're getting at?
I want everyone to, you know, say that. I want to try to influence the way people think about that. So, you know, it is 24 hours. It would be nice to have said 24 hours, but I thought 25 hours. Just like I was watching too much Spinal Tap at the time, you know, 25 hours.
I've never seen Spinal Tap. I wouldn't
know. Okay.
So that reference went.
Okay. Good.
You know, I think this is the first time Pericles and Spinal Tap have been in like the same situation. So we're breaking new ground here. So
if people don't understand, I'll have to get on the internet and look for, but these go up to 11. That's the thing.
Oh, okay. All right. Some hard hitting research there.
Yes. Okay. But so I think done differently in my research as opposed to other, people who are researching the Gettysburg Address, is I tried to break down exactly the different components of Lincoln's visit, including the train ride here, and talk about each facet of the visit, and then do it from not just the perspective of the dignitaries that were here or the well-known writers that have discussed it over the years, but also from the local people that were here. At the beginning of some of my research, I tried to point out that, again, if there's these 10,000 people, you know, hear the Gettysburg Address and are from this area, as they get older, their obituaries are filled with interesting comments about how they were born on this date, they married this person, this is the name of their children, and oh, by the way, they attended Lincoln's Gettysburg Address. And as time went by and the Gettysburg Address became well known on a national level, the people who attended wanted to be associated with it and tied in with it and wanted it known that they were a part of this major event. So it became something that was written in their obituaries. They shook hands with Lincoln. They heard Lincoln. They saw Lincoln that day.
And then they died.
Yeah. And then they usually died before this was written. Yeah. And then they died. So it's fascinating in that respect to me that this event became so desirable for one to have been at. Now, of course, we're historians. We know that a lot of people who probably tell people they went to Gettysburg just really weren't, or they went downtown, or they toured the battlefield and didn't listen to them. And the other thing I find interesting about the Gettysburg Address is that, let's say there is a crowd of 15,000 people that day. Everyone in the crowd heard every single word he said. You know, no doubt about that.
So have you found anybody who you can pretty much find was said they were here but were not?
It's kind of hard to prove a negative. So I would still say yes, that there are.
I was just wondering if you found like some random Weikert that was lying or something. Or, you know, I just didn't know. So
Okay. Well, for instance, Jenny Wade's mother.
Well, she wasn't here
Jenny
for
Wade
it.
Wasn't here.
We know that.
Jenny Wade's sister, Georgia, when she dies, there's in her obituary, it states that she was on the platform with Abraham Lincoln when he gave the address, and she clearly was not. We have other accounts of her, and she clearly was not. And the story, I guess, came about at some point where Lincoln learned of Jenny Wade's death, so he went down and talked to Jenny Wade's mother, and Jenny Wade's mother and sister came up and sat on the platform with him. One thing about the address that you can easily figure out is that 368 people are not on the platform. If everyone was on the platform who says they were on the platform, on the address, you know, the platform's the size of like Noah's Ark.
Well, what are they, like 30 people? Isn't it like three rows of 10 or something like that?
Yeah. I mean, and then here's the thing that's obvious when you read the accounts of it. There's a couple times when a choir comes up onto the stage and sings. And I'm really confused about this. Do they come up and huddle in front of the other people sitting on the platform? Or do they, because in their accounts later, they're all sitting on the platform listening to the whole address. But I think they just come up, they're on the platform, they sing their hymn or dirge or whatever, and then they go back off the platform.
Gotcha.
But yeah, it can't be more than 30 people on the platform.
Back to who saw it and who didn't. Isn't there a quote attributed to Sally Myers where she kind of described?
I think Sally Myers says that she saw Lincoln go up and then she went back home and washed some clothes.
Too many crowds or something.
Yeah, she didn't like all the people, so she wasn't there.
All right. Hey, back to the train ride. So myths and misconceptions. Does Lincoln work on the speech on the train or what's going on there, Tim?
Yeah, well, that's fascinating subject. Of course, there are Lincoln Gettysburg myths, and there's quite a number of them we could talk about, like the horse he rode on, or did someone, you know, was there applause at the Gettysburg Address or not? But one of the ones that you hear a lot is that Gettysburg Address was written on the back of an envelope on the train on the way to Gettysburg. And this story first appears in I think I picked it up in like an 1887 biography of Lincoln. And there's several different versions of it that are in the newspapers during the 1890s and early 1900s. One was by a guy, I think it's written in like 1897, where he says he and his father visited Governor Curtin after the Gettysburg Address. And he says that Governor Curtin told him that on the train ride to Gettysburg that Lincoln asked him for some paper, and he provided him with some paper, and he saw Lincoln write the address on the train. So this is like one of the things people point to as proof of this. And of course, Curtin was on a different train than Lincoln. And usually these things are easily dispelled. There's this one account of this, Lincoln writing it on the train, that appears as an interview by Edward McPherson. And of course, Edward McPherson was not on the train that Lincoln rode on. And then, of course, the story really catches attention when it's part of Mary Raymond Shipman Andrews' book, The Perfect Tribute. And in her book, she has Abraham Lincoln writing the Gettysburg Address on the train. What really interesting to me, that one of the things I found out, is that the train ride from Hanover Junction to Gettysburg, see, the train that he rode on went from Washington to Baltimore, and then he had to transfer to the Northern Central and went up the Northern Central Railroad to Hanover Junction, which is about 16 miles east of Hanover, and then he got on the Gettysburg-Hanover-Hanover Junction branch of that railroad. And all the travelers that came by train to the Gettysburg Address were on that branch. And they describe it as a horrible experience and the worst engineered railroad in the United States, consistently. So here's Lincoln on, you know, this horrible train, bouncing them down, and he's writing this on the back of the envelope. So, you know, the story's apocryphal. It's well known that Abraham Lincoln wrote the Gettysburg Address in the White House, you know, and he'd been working on it for a long time. There's accounts of different people where they visit him. He actually reads it and, you know, as practice, and asks them what they think and is adding things. And the thing that I think has confused people over the years is that we have one account by David Wills. And David Wills says, that's where Lincoln stays on the night of the 18th. He says that Lincoln called him to the room and Lincoln asked him for paper. And the next day, he says, when Lincoln was on the platform, he saw Lincoln reading from the piece of paper he gave him. So we believe that the copy he read from on the platform is what I guess it's referred to as a Nicolay copy. Mm-hmm. At the, is it held at the National Archives?
Library of Congress.
Library of Congress. And one page of that is on White House stationery, and the second page is on a different paper. So I would suggest that Lincoln had the address written, but that night at the Wills house, he must have did something or changed something in near the end of it. And that's why, you know, it's on two different pieces of paper. And that's probably what David Wills is referring to. So I always just like to say that Lincoln put the finishing touches on the Gettysburg Address while he's at the Wills house.
You'd kind of hope he's not pulling an all-nighter, right? The night before, and just saying, okay, I got to come up with something, right?
The thing about the train ride that, again, a lot of people probably are not aware of is that Lincoln's train leaves Washington, D.C., and comes into Baltimore. Maybe it's the first time he's back in Baltimore since he snuck through there in the middle of the night. I think some people have pointed out that he went to Antietam Battlefield, but he probably stopped south of Baltimore and went over on the Relay House and went over. I don't know. But after Lincoln passed through Baltimore on the Northern Central, he was supposed to meet Governor Curtin's train at Hanover Junction. But there was an accident on the tracks. Governor Curtin's train had some engine trouble, I believe. And Governor Curtin's train, which carried a lot of the different governors that were attending the ceremony, didn't reach Hanover Junction on time. Lincoln sat at Hanover Junction for a while, and then they decided just to take his four cars over to Gettysburg by themselves. Now, I should just mention, it's not that important, but the train that was coming up from Baltimore and the train that was coming down from Harrisburg, they were too large to ride on the Hanover Junction line. So they had to switch the cars to another local locomotive to bring him over to Gettysburg. And so Lincoln came ahead and he got here about 6:30 at the latest on the 18th. And there wasn't much of a crowd waiting at the train station because it wasn't a schedule. There wasn't a strict schedule. No one exactly knew when he was coming, unless somebody telegraphed ahead and the crowd developed. But one thing we do know, Edward Everett's in the crowd because his daughter Charlotte is on the train.
I think it's interesting you mentioned Andrew Curtin earlier, and with his train being delayed, he will meet with Lincoln on the night of the 18th. And I believe Curtin mentions that there's a yellow envelope by Lincoln, which perhaps is this where this all develops? Is this just another Gettysburg myth that starts with something and develops?
For the listeners at home, let the record show Tim has that expression on his face right now.
Well, the thing is, you know, Governor Curtin's train arrives at midnight. Mm-hmm. And so I'm thinking that he doesn't meet with Lincoln at night because Lincoln's already asleep. But I don't know that. You know, you have to.
Well, there's the moment where Lincoln walks down the street also to see Seward.
Yes.
So, yes. You know, I think that's the time when I was researching, it seems the time is very, well, as we like to say, fluid.
The time is fluid. And, yes. So the other thing that I really like is that when Governor Curtin finally arrives, you know, he arrives and he's invited to the Wills house too. And apparently there's 38 people in the Wills house that night. Mm-hmm. So he's brought upstairs and they really don't have any room for Governor Curtin. So they want to put him in the same bed with Edward Everett. And they knock on Edward Everett's door and wake him up. And he says, absolutely not. He's the keynote speaker. So,
but you know what? There's nothing wrong with that if they did.
That's right. Yeah, you get that in Lincoln lore a lot that, you know, especially when Lincoln's traveling on the lawyer circuit in Indiana and Illinois, that men share a bed together. And I think that's misconstrued in some of these later
moving
accounts.
Right along.
Yeah, clearly the path I thought we were going tonight. Exactly. And
And here we were worried about too many wrestling references.
Yeah, really.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But one interesting thing also is that you might hear this story. This is from Edward Everett, that Charlotte is in bed with two other women, and in the middle of the night, the bed breaks.
Oh, my God.
Because of the immense weight.
Maybe and this story we do want to hear.
Yeah, they roll out onto the floor, and apparently everybody in the house wakes up.
There goes our clean rating on iTunes
our
there.
Well, just lost our,
yeah, it's good while we had it.
You know, when I was thinking of stripping away our family-friendly rating, yeah. I wasn't thinking Tim Smith would be the guy to do
that. Yeah, and usually when you do that, you want to, like, scale it up. Like, we just totally ripped the Band-Aid off at this point, so.
Boy, where were we? Women rolling around on the floor?
So back to Lincoln.
Yeah, back to Lincoln.
Well, there's a couple interesting things that happened on the 18th, the night before the Gettysburg Address, when Lincoln arrives. And, you know, Lincoln walks from the Lincoln train station. Of course, the train station is still there, and it's one of the features of the town that's associated with Lincoln's visit. But he comes up to the square, and he spends the night at the David Wills house. There's a dinner party there. I always find it interesting, too, a sidelight of that is that, can you imagine Mrs. Wills and David, who's a prominent attorney, helped Governor Curtin get elected, was the agent of the Soldiers National Cemetery, very prominent man in our town. But he invited Lincoln to stay at their house. So at some point, he's got to go to his wife and, the president is coming to stay at our house. And, I promised there'd be a dinner party, and I don't know, 38 people are going to come to the dinner party. And Catherine Smizer Wills is 8 months pregnant at the time.
Yeah.
So they did have this dinner party. On the president's train, I believe they came on the president's train, was the Marine Band from Washington, D.C. Also in town was the 5th New York Artillery Band. They were stationed at Fort McHenry. So they had come along with a detachment of the 5th New York Artillery. And these two bands gathered in the square in front of the Wills house and played songs. And a crowd developed of all these visitors. I wonder how many people were in town that night. You read these accounts where every house is filled, every barn is filled, every hotel is filled, and people are like sleeping in carriages and wagons on the street.
Well, first of all, so you mentioned the number. Do you accept the generally accepted number of 15,000, or do you have your own thoughts on that?
Well, you know, I don't know what to make of it. But here's something that I found interesting in this, that 15,000 is the low figure of all the estimates that have been given. You see, the Adams Sentinel, I believe, gives 15 to 30,000 of the estimates, and they say they thought it was 30,000. The Chicago Tribune, I think, one of the Chicago papers, gives 50,000 as the estimate. When in the world have we ever had an event and someone accepts the low estimation as the figure? Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'm always surprised that people have you know, stated 15,000, when you look at all the estimates, that seems to be the low estimate. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of people. And who knows how many of these people went to the cemetery and heard the address, or how many are touring the battlefield. And then we hear accounts of people that can't get here, that the train's delayed, they don't get here till after it's over. There's all kinds of interesting sidelights to this. I don't think that there is any way for us to possibly count.
How could we know?
Yeah, so that's interesting. But one thing is clear, that because there's so many people and there's no place to sleep, a large amount of people just roamed the streets the night of the 18th, apparently drinking. And you hear these counts where this crowd of drinkers goes from the Wills house and the bands to, let's see where Seward's staying. Let's see if we can get him to give a speech. And then, you know, then they go down Baltimore Street and they asked other people to make speeches. And various newspapers give accounts of these various speeches by these dignitaries that night in the town that can be brought out by the, I don't know what you want to call them, the carousing crowd.
Yeah, the carousing crowd is no different than Gettysburg in 2023, right?
Yeah, I was going to say, it's not like on November 18th, yeah, do people drink heavily here in Gettysburg before Remembrance Day,
Except you know? In 1863, the people had a purpose. Today, they just kind of, you know, aimlessly wander.
Yeah.
So starting then with speeches.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of anecdotes. Lincoln is supposedly asked to speak that evening after dinner. You want to pick it up there?
Yeah, so the bands are playing out in the Wills house. It attracts a crowd, thousands of people. Again, you know, we don't know the number, are, you know, standing out in the square. And isn't it interesting we call it the square, you know, because it's a circle. Yeah. But they're standing out in the square, and they're yelling for Lincoln to come out. And so Lincoln does come out on the York Street side, and he basically says, I'll paraphrase it, he says, in my position, it is important that I not say any foolish things. And to do that, it often so happens that I should not say anything. And then he, like, goes back inside. And there's several versions of this in the newspaper. There's reporters there, and these reporters are writing down very quickly. I'm sure they have, like, a scratch hand or a short hand that they write down. Because there's one guy who wrote down the Gettysburg Address and did it pretty well while Lincoln was giving it. But these speeches are interesting. And one of the versions suggests that Lincoln said it is important not to say anything, you know, inappropriate. But a guy in the crowd supposedly yells, if you can help it. You know, I shouldn't say anything foolish, if I can help it. So some of the versions have Lincoln saying, if I can help it. And some of the versions have a guy in a crowd yelling that. And just looking at them, it's really hard to say what you know actually he said. But basically, he came out, he said hi to the crowd, he said absolutely nothing, and he went back inside. When I was a kid, the Gettysburg Wax Museum said that the band asked him if there's a song he'd like to hear while he was standing outside. And Lincoln said he'd like to hear Dixie. This is absolutely not true.
You heard it here.
But it got a lot of attention because...
Did you fired up just a little bit by
it
that?
It did.
Fired up Tim Smith.
But this story is used a lot in context with Lincoln. Not just at Gettysburg Address, but often it's used when he's at the White House and he's making an important speech and he says this at the end of the speech. Let's hear that great song by that great Southern band, you know. So you hear that sometimes, but it did not happen during the Gettysburg Address. It's just kind of one of those things added that you hear.
Well, is that not the thing about the Gettysburg Address and Lincoln's visit? For every one account that seems to suggest this, there's another account that suggests almost the total opposite.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the more challenging aspects of kind of unpacking all of this.
I love it.
What's real, yeah, what's not, what's a combination, what's total bunk. I think whatever version of Lincoln's visit you want, you can kind of create for yourself if you really want to go that far.
That's true. And you know, I think that's an important thing about history. You know, what I guess what bothers me is when people dive into these different accounts and they just reach and pick, okay, this is the one that happened. Mm-hmm. you know, so they'll just go with it. And they feel like some people writing that they have to have a fluid story. And I don't mind at all running off on tangents, say, oh, well, you know, some people said this happened, but other people said it was like this. And of course, there's a couple of things coming up here in a second I'm going to get to that are exactly like that.
How about William Tipton?
Oh, yeah.
You are well known in these parts. You do not like Dan Sickles. We're not big fans of William Tipton, but does...
We don't like battlefield desecrators.
That's right, the
desecration.
Destroyer of the battlefield.
Yeah.
But doesn't the destroyer... I think he's like only 13 years old in 18.
Yeah.
Doesn't he leave an account?
Is that his ring name?
The
destroyer?
It is after
the destroyer.
Tonight.
Okay.
The desecrator.
Isn't Tipton one of the... I just thought maybe I would throw...
Yeah, William Tipton is 12 years old at the time, and he's an apprentice to the Tyson Brothers Photographic Studio. And as luck would have it, you know, the Wills house and where Lincoln came out on York Street, the next building on the second floor is where the Tyson Brothers Photographic Studio was. And we have a very good account by him where he's at the studio, he opens up the window, and he leans out and he hears... this speech by Lincoln that night. You know, it stays with him the rest of his life. And William Tipton did go up to the cemetery the next day and hear the address. And he's one of those figures that for the rest of his life, you know, talks about Abraham Lincoln and the address that was given that night and what kind of impact next day, the impact that Lincoln's visit had on him. And he's a 12-year-old boy. So I love to talk about William Tipton. And again, you know, William Tipton has good and bad facets, and you know, I don't have to like, you know, him because I wrote about him or something like that. But you know, it's really hard, isn't it, with historical figures, because you don't really know exactly what they were like. Mm-hmm. You might go back in time and find out you really like somebody that you thought you wouldn't, mm-hmm. or you don't like somebody you thought you would. But I think that's what we try to do probably as historians. We read as much as about the person as we can and try to, you know, try to figure out what they're like. But definitely William Tipton's complex.
Doesn't William Tipton leave an account about another myth, the horse?
Yes. Yes. Mm-hmm. So we'll bring that up in a second. Mm-hmm. But let me just hit the end of the 18th. You know, Lincoln sleeps in the Wills house. And I wanted to mention, we do have an account that's really interesting by Hugh Paxton Bigham, and he is with the 21st Pennsylvania Cavalry, and he's outside of William Tipton's door that night. And he is the one who a telegram arrives from the telegraph office. And I should mention it, members of the 21st Pennsylvania Cavalry were all over the town that night mm-hmm. as a sort of a provost guard. But one of them was at the telegraph office, one of them was at the Wills door, and he was at the bedroom door for Abraham Lincoln. But a telegram arrived in the middle of the night, and he writes about it later in his life, and he knocks on the door and delivers a message, and then Lincoln comes back to him and tells him that it was a telegram from Mary from the White House, I guess forwarded by Edwin Stanton, that Tad is doing better. And Tad had been sick, and he thought about not coming to the Gettysburg Address because Tad had been sick. And, of course, Willie died the year before in the White House, and Mary didn't want him to come to give to the ceremonies. So I think it's just a fascinating story. And then you mentioned, Jim, earlier, that then Lincoln comes to him and asks him to take him to see Seward. And then, so he goes out of the Wills house, goes through the crowd around the corner, and then he goes up to the Harper house, and Seward and Lincoln have some kind of conversation. I'm guessing that he probably rehearsed the Gettysburg Address with William Seward. And then Lincoln goes back to the Wills house and spends the night. And that's kind of how the 18th ends. And then the drunken crowd goes around. One thing I'll mention about William Seward, the crowd yells for him to come out, and he's in the house just next to Lincoln on the square. William Seward comes out and gives a speech. And the reporters are writing, you know, what he's saying down. And then he has a secretary hand out copies of his speech to the reporters. So his speech is like well known in the newspapers. Now, I want you to try to find William Seward's speech in one of these newspaper articles and read it. Because there's a lot of sentences in that speech that sound really familiar. It's kind of just like the Gettysburg Address. So my thought is Seward stealing from Lincoln because he knows what Lincoln's going to say? Or, as Seward fans would say, is Lincoln copying from Seward's thoughts? Because, you know, he was supposed to be the president and accept the nomination, but that never happened at the Chicago Convention. Just throwing that out there. And here's, to me, it's funny that I talk about this to people all the time, to other historians, and like we were just talking about, you know, different thoughts on different things. And everybody has, like, different versions that they believe in or things that they like. The most contentious thing that I've ever talked about with Lincoln scholars is this morning of the 19th. So you'd have to ask the different Lincoln scholars how they feel about this and get their response to my comments. But basically, Lincoln scholars want you to believe that on the morning of the 19th, Lincoln toured the battlefield. I cannot find any evidence that he left the Wills house and toured the battlefield. Okay, there's the two different interpretations.
So even some of these guys who I think kind of imply he just takes a quick ride down the pike to see where Reynolds got shot, your opinion is no evidence?
I just haven't found any evidence. For their accounts, to Lincoln has to sneak out of the Wills house. So Lincoln gets somebody, we don't even know who it would be, gets a carriage or a wagon, probably a carriage, sneaks out of the Wills house early in the morning, takes a tour of the battlefield, and then sneaks back in without the thousands of, maybe they're all drunk and sleeping on the sidewalk.
So I knew this was a thing. I'm not a Lincoln guy. I guess I didn't realize it's a contentious thing. Where's that kind of...
Why is it a contentious? You know, I asked two of them that I was arguing with different days about. I asked him, why can't you accept that he didn't tour the battlefield? And it's because they want Lincoln to understand the battle and how horrible it was and have seen the battle to make some kind of impact. Somehow that has something to do with the impact of his speech, that he saw the battlefield. I'll tell you where he saw the battlefield. When he's riding by the Farnsworth house, he saw the bullet holes in the side of it.
But I'm sorry, it was the Sweeney house?
That's right.
Yes, I believe it was the Sweeney house.
The Harvey Sweeney house. Very good.
We got that on air, folks.
Good.
That's live and recorded.
I think in the 1940s, there's an article by one of the tour guides in Gettysburg that he wrote that he stopped at Carrie Sheed's house and talked to Carrie Sheeds. And that's getting a little bit of play. But other accounts say that, yeah, here's the thing. Here, I don't know what you guys think about this, but here's how I've heard it put sometimes. Well, he felt that it was, you know, he needed to ride out to the seminary and the first day's battlefield to see where his good friend, John Fulton Reynolds, was killed. Okay,
place.
Wait a minute. Yeah. What evidence is there that Lincoln and Reynolds are friends?
Or how do we know he just didn't go out there and say, see, should have taken the job offer? So there you go.
Good, good. But then,
come on, it's been 160 years, folks. It's all right.
Is it not too soon for Reynolds?
Yeah, come on. Yeah.
So even I think after, you know, discussing it with many people, I think even a hardened historian would have to, you know, Lincoln historian would have to admit that if he did ride out to the battlefield, he rode out to the seminary, stopped, turned around and came back. Mm-hmm. You know, he's not touring like Little Round Top or Cemetery Ridge. He just can't fit time in his schedule for him to tour the battlefield.
Like most battlefield guides, he's not getting to Culp's Hill. We know that.
So I have looked into some of the claims by some of these people who say they found stuff to suggest he did tour the battlefield. And there is one account where a reporter is near the platform, and he says to William Seward, oh, I stopped by to see you today, and you weren't there at the Harper House this morning. And Seward says, yeah, Lincoln and I were out touring the battlefield together. That's why I wasn't there. So that's one of their sources for Lincoln touring the battlefield, an overheard conversation with Seward and this reporter. So, again, to me, that kind of thing is fascinating, that we assume Lincoln toured the battlefield, but, you know, besides riding to the cemetery and riding back, really did not.
Well, and we have to contend they did have somewhat of a schedule that day.
Yeah, which is good.
I mean, you have to factor that in. It's not like Lincoln's just here wandering around aimlessly.
And
you know, there's a schedule for a parade. Yeah. There's a time they want to do this event. Yeah. So you have to factor that in,
too. Mrs. Wills might be delivering that baby if it comes
early. Yeah, anytime now. Hey, should we start a rumor that Lincoln delivered the child?
Yeah. You know, And then, you know, before we get to the horse, which I love.
Wait, he delivered
the horse.
A horse, too?
Oh, my God.
What can't this guy do?
Well, he can slay vampires, too.
Yes, he can. Yes, he can.
There's an interesting thing that Ward Lamont, or do you like to call him Layman or Lemon? I know people have pronounced his name in different fashions. Have you heard
any
of this?
I haven't put that much thought
to it. Okay. So Lincoln's good friend who comes, the day before and tries to prepare for the ceremonies, he actually has like a program of events published by the local newspaper that, you know, a program, and we have a copy of it on display in our Gettysburg Beyond the Battle Museum. So if you want to see that, but there's a program printed up. Yep, right here at the Adams County Historical Society.
But don't leave yet.
Yeah.
Yeah, don't.
Doesn't mean
don't
go
running
see it
out
now.
To look at it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Stay for the rest of this.
In this schedule of events, it tells you that they're going to have this procession leading to the National Cemetery, and it's starting in the Square of Gettysburg, and it lists all the different people that are in procession. And what happens is that all the people who are going to be part of the ceremony show up in the square to be organized for this procession. And all the people who came to hear, you know, the dedication ceremony and to be there that day all showed up in the square at the appointed time. So can you imagine 15,000 people in the square? And the make the long story short, the procession did not get underway at the specified time because of the crowd. Lincoln came out, got on a horse, and just sat there for, I don't know, a half an hour on the horse. And that's when a lot of people were able to make their way through the crowd and walk over to him, and he shook their hand, or they had comments with him, or they saw him. So a lot of people noted during that time while they're waiting. But it was a scene of chaos and confusion, and it took a long time for the procession to get going. And when it finally did get going, there was an order given to the procession, and they headed down Baltimore Street to the Soldiers National Cemetery. And, of course, this gets into one of another favorite myth, and that's the horse. And a lot of the local townspeople in their account, they really like this myth, so they'll promote it. But basically, Abraham Lincoln was given a horse that was too short. And one of the accounts specifically mentions it was one of the Democrats of Gettysburg who supplied the horse.
That's right. Some things never change.
Lincoln gets on this horse. According to the locals, the horse is too short. His feet are dragging the ground. And according to Henry Easter Jacobs, you know, it appeared as if he could just put his feet on the ground and the horse would ride out from under him. Now, when you look into it deeper, of course, that's the simple story. When you look into it deeper, we have a bunch of accounts of the horse, and it becomes a little bit of an argument over the years. And later on, most people are like, that's ridiculous. William Tipton, for instance, like, that's not true. He was given one of the finest horses in the Cumberland Valley. The horse, basically what it was, according to the locals, is Lincoln's legs are really long. And he is, according to Daniel Skelly, one of the oddest people he'd ever seen on a horse because of his tall stature. But Lincoln was a fine horseman, and they said he looked very comfortable on the horse. According to Henry Clay Cochran, who's the Marine guard, he says, though, that Seward is not much of a horseman at all. And Seward has all kinds of problems. Mm. But also, Lincoln has that high top hat on. And when he's going down in a procession, he looks a lot taller than all the other people. So that's another one of the myths you'll read about the horse.
And is it not one of those situations, if you like Lincoln,
yes,
he's on a great charger, he's a great horseman, but if you don't like Lincoln, he's, you know, basically got like a backup from Land of Little Horses. His legs are all ungangly. He's falling off the horse. I mean, I think it all depends on your perspective of the man, too.
That's absolutely true. Absolutely. And let me just give you an example. That's really good. And I think everybody should know that this. Yeah, have you ever heard the story that people like to tell that after the Gettysburg Address, no one really understood how great it was, and it didn't really affect them. And it wasn't until years later that people started remarking about how great the address was, and it grew on people. That's not true at all. What is happening is, if you read a Republican newspaper, Lincoln made an awesome speech, and everyone who was there appreciated it greatly. But if you read one of the Democratic newspapers, it was a horrible speech. It was silly. People laughed. No one applauded. And so, you know, there's a Chicago newspaper that really trashes the Gettysburg Address. But it's all politics. It's not really about how great the speech was or not. And there are people right away who appreciate it, like Edward Everett.
Well, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, there seems to be a political component to this, because even the decision to bring Lincoln here had political implications. Yeah, I mean, is he going to give a stump speech here?
Yeah.
Or they're worried he's going to give silly remarks that are off color and could embarrass himself. I mean, these were questions they were contending with. So if there's questions ahead of time, there's going to be questions the day of and the day after and in the immediate weeks. And you can't escape it.
You know what I think that's interesting, too? Well, it's always been interesting to me, is that the Gettysburg Address is a war speech.
Yeah.
A lot of people are like, well, the Gettysburg Address is about, like, all men are created equal. And, you know, it's a, you know, harping back to the Declaration of Independence and things. But it's really a speech where a country that is torn by war needs to find focus to continue the war to its final conclusion, you know, and end the war. And, you know, by all accounts of what happened, it was pretty successful in refocusing our attention on the, you know, why we need to continue fighting.
I had that on the list tonight, since we've kind of blown the chronology here. I'll get to that. So I see this argued on social media a lot, that the Gettysburg Address is speaking to everybody, North and South, and democracy and freedom and all of that stuff. And you kind of just hit on it. So I would kind of ask you just to kind of rewind there a little bit. And so you basically have characterized it as a war speech. And I agree. I'm no scholar on it, but I think it's this idea that trying to tell the nation, hey, we've got to finish the job here, or that. Mm-hmm. But to this social media debate that I see a lot, is he or is he not also speaking to the South about coming back? Or are you really just talking to the Northern population here saying, stay the course? I think he's mostly just talking to the North, but what do you think?
Oh, I thought he was, I don't see, I'm trying to think here. I have to think hard of the words, but I don't see much, talking to the South in it. He's in a cemetery where Northern soldiers are buried and no Southern soldier are allowed to be buried.
Lincoln knew his audience.
Yeah.
Well, but he also knows it's going to be carried out in newspapers as well. Mm-hmm. But yeah, but no, I agree. I see this a lot, and I wanted you to kind of, like Lincoln the Vampire Hunter, put kind of a stake in that and just kind of kill that.
Yeah. And but again, maybe it's not my place to do this, because I'm not a Lincoln scholar. But to me, it's just a great speech.
Okay, well, let's get him to the cemetery.
Okay.
Anything else happens in town?
We do have accounts of him. That's where a lot of townspeople talk about him coming down through the town in a procession and then heading up to Cemetery Hill. One thing I should mention is that when he gets to the intersection of Baltimore Street and the Tawnytown, or I should say Steinway Avenue, you know, the Emmitsburg Road, he makes a right. And I don't think a lot of people realize the procession goes down past the Dobbin House. And then the procession turns onto the Tawnytown Road. And then it goes across the fields up and over to Cemetery Hill. I noticed a lot of times people in general, you know, studies of the Gettysburg Address, have them going up, going through the gatehouse to get there, going up Baltimore Street. No, he went up Steinway and the Tawnytown Road.
So I have to take all that Lincoln artwork off of my wall that hasn't gone through.
I don't know if he passes on his way out. Oh, I don't know if he passes through there. That's a good question. But when they get there, then, you know, they have that just a long ceremony there with a benediction and some hymns. And of course, Edward Everett speaks for 2 hours. And I'm sure we could spend a lot of time talking about Edward Everett's speech. And then there's, you know, a dirge. And finally, Lincoln gives the address that people have been waiting for. But I think it's worth noting that people stood around for 2 hours. Apparently, it got into the 50s. It was more like an Indian summer day, according to some accounts. So at first, it didn't seem like it was going to be a nice day, but then it got kind of sunny. And, people mentioned they were getting hot or uncomfortable waiting for Lincoln to finally give the address.
Yeah, don't some of the accounts say that the crowd is so close that some people are actually getting sick and kind of stepping
out? Yeah. I found, and I was just looking at it in my notes yesterday, I found an account, I think it's in like a history of the Smizer family, where their cousin from Baltimore is in front of the crowd during Edward Everett's speech, and she pretends to faint. And then some guys carry her up, and she gets to sit on the stage in a chair. And her cousins are like, oh.
Jody, any commentary on Baltimore women on that one?
No.
Yeah,
cousin from Baltimore. Also, should we mention that it was the Baltimore Glee Club that actually sung the hymn or the dirge while they were up there on the stand. And some local girls assisted with that. A guy named Horner, I think, from Baltimore. Okay. But there's a lot of, you can read Edward Everett's speech. And, you know, Edward Everett is a great orator. You know, I mean, and that's what people loved at that time, for people to make these long orations. Do you know, prior to the Civil War, Edward Everett had gone around the country. He made 100 two-hour-long speeches on the life of George Washington to raise money for the ladies of Mount Vernon.
Yeah.
So he was a great orator. He was a former governor of Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. He was a United States congressman.
Secretary of State.
Secretary of State. Yeah. He was the United States ambassador to England at one time. Was he the president of Harvard at one time?
Vice presidential nominee.
He was a vice presidential nominee.
Wouldn't share his bed the night before.
Well, because he's a big deal. If you got a resume like that, you know.
Yeah. And so, you know, they wanted him to, you know, speak. And one thing I should mention here is that and this is interesting also when you read the Lincoln histories, that David Wills wanted Abraham Lincoln to know that he was not the keynote speaker, that Edward Everett was going to be the keynote speaker. So in the letter that he wrote Abraham Lincoln on November 2nd, David Wills said that he was to make a few appropriate remarks. And if you hear that phrase, that comes from David Wills. Mm-hmm. So although Lincoln gave the Gettysburg Address and delivered it, I think we should note that it was a local Adams County guy born in Bendersville, Manalan Township, that actually created the framework by which the Gettysburg Address was written.
Local talent.
Well, and isn't there some evidence that Lincoln talks with Wills a little bit
about
the
what's
house,
expected
about what exactly
of
you want me to do tomorrow? You know, what's the context of this? Yeah. How do you want this to go?
Yeah.
And
can I, we have to do a little bit of housekeeping. Can I give the folks a sample of the Edward Everett version of this?
You may.
Okay.
Is this going to be the first line?
It's all 2 hours, actually.
Yeah. So I am curious when we do something. How many of you are regular listeners to the show? Because I'm sure some are just ACHS. Okay. So those who don't listen, and most of you do listen, know we do something called the Dan Sickles Report.
Hey, Tim, how do you feel about Sickles being cheered in this room right now?
I'm used to it.
So I thought just to give him a flavor, I would randomly pick a selection from Edward Everett's True Gettysburg Address. And without further ado, give me a minute here.
Hey, Jim, you can't do that. That's another show that uses that.
A forward movement of General Sickles to gain a commanding position from which to repel the rebel attack drew upon him a destructive fire from the enemy's batteries and a furious assault from Longstreet and Hill's advancing troops. After a brave resistance on the part of his corps, he was forced back, himself falling severely wounded. This was the critical moment of the second day. Thank you very much.
And you know what I like about that is that, you know, a lot of people don't realize that Edward Everett's two-hour speech although it had, you know, all kinds of rhetoric in it, it actually was a description mm-hmm. of the battle.
Right.
And it was one of the first published descriptions of the battle that was widely spread in newspapers. So people read it in newspapers, and it got a lot more attention, you know, people reading it than people having to stand there and listen to it. But I almost entirely, the local people who wrote about Edward Everett's speech afterwards were not very excited about it.
Yeah.
They're a little bit nasty sometimes, but nobody exactly appreciated the length of the speech. So, you know, and then, of course, you know, I don't know what your thoughts about it. Lincoln gives the Gettysburg Address. You hear a lot of stories written about it that no one clapped. But I got to tell you, the newspaper transcriptions of it that tried to write down what he said, they have spaces in there, applause, mm-hmm. you know, large applause, continued applause. So throughout the speech, people are applauding according to that newspaper article. Now, we have, I should mention, there are five known versions of Abraham Lincoln's Gettysburg Address in his own hand. In other words, afterwards, he was asked by people to write down what he said. In only one of the five does he use the words under God. Mm-hmm. And in the version that he was holding, that we believe he is holding, under God is not in that one. But it is in the transcription given by the newspaper reporters.
Right.
So it's obvious that he threw it in, that he'd been thinking about saying it, and threw it in as he was giving the speech. What I like about the five versions, and we're not exactly sure which, you know, version he gave, you can just take the newspaper transcription, I guess, and say, okay, it was this one. They're all different. They all have a different amount of words, and they're all slightly different. So when you hear, like, someone give the Gettysburg Address, I'm always interested in which version are they giving.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen, you know, you can tell, you watch something, you're like, oh. And then my thing that I think about the Gettysburg Address all the time is that people try to do it, and they almost immediately mess it up. Our forefathers brought forth. Why do they do that? Why does everybody say our forefathers instead of our fathers brought forth?
I do have a copy of the Bliss version here.
Oh, okay.
Would you be interested in reading it? Or the, you know, a little dramatic reading to counterbalance?
No, I know.
Yeah, well, would you like to?
Do I have to do it?
Well, you don't have to. Or
would you want to do
the
it?
The three of you kind of could split okay, messages.
Okay,
or
okay.
All right,
okay.
Hold on. Let me cue the music again, because I think that's an important component. Okay, now they're basically in the music. There's about 3 minutes and 45 seconds left, so let's see if we can...
Okay,
so you want to know why we don't have a fourth mic? We blew all our money on our music budget tonight.
Yes.
So
Before we do that, let me ask one question. I was just mentioning to these guys up here before that there was a game I played when I was a kid. It was a Civil War game. Does anybody have this? And the very last thing, when you got to the last part, you had to... like recite the first line of the Gettysburg Address in the game to win. And then if you messed up, you had to, you know, wait till the next round and try it. But, oh, I wanted to mention, common mistake people make, our forefathers brought forth, that's in Kindergarten Cop. Arnold Schwarzenegger gets the Gettysburg Address wrong.
Oh, of course. Oh, there you go.
Those cute little kids, yeah.
We are really hitting all topics tonight. This is a wide-ranging discussion, truly.
I'm ready.
Are you ready? All right. 3, 2, 1.
47 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation, conceived in liberty and dedicated to a proposition that all men are created equal.
Now we are engaged in a great civil war, testing whether that nation or any nation so conceived and so dedicated can long endure. We are met on a great battlefield of that war. We have come to dedicate a portion of that field as a final resting place for those who here gave their lives that nation might live. It is altogether fitting and proper that we should do this.
But in a larger sense, we cannot dedicate, we cannot consecrate, we cannot hallow this ground. The brave men, living and dead, who struggled here have consecrated it far above our poor power to add or detract. The world will little note nor long remember what we say here, but it can never forget what they did here. It is for us, the living, rather, to be dedicated here to the unfinished work which they who fought here have thus far so nobly advanced. It is rather for us to be here dedicated to the great task remaining before us, that from these honored dead we take increased devotion to that cause for which they gave the last full measure of devotion. That we here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain, that this nation, under God, shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from this earth.
Oh, that's good. I'm weeping. I'm openly weeping on mic here. That was great, guys.
Now, we only got one applause line there. Lincoln supposedly got five.
Yeah, that's right.
So, well.
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, well.
Yeah, right.
It wasn't new. We
need new material.
You know, being a tour guide, it's fascinating, and I'm curious about your, you know, attitudes towards it. We were talking about earlier, before you guys assembled here, we were all talking about it, and I think it's well worth noting now that we have a really low percentage of visitors that see the National Cemetery. Remember, in the older days, the visitor center was across the street from the entrance to the cemetery, and during that time, there was a huge amount of visitation to the cemetery while people were just visiting the battlefield and visiting the museum. And now, you know, the museum, the visitor center is somewhere else, and you have to make a special visit to the cemetery. And it seems like to me, most of the time during the day, there's very few people there. But we do have people in the summer, you know, at night going on the free battlefield tours of the cemetery with the tour guides. But, you know, being a tour guide during the time when it seemed like the cemetery got a lot heavier visitation, and also giving tours of the cemetery, I've had a bunch of things happen to me associated with the Gettysburg Address in the cemetery while I've given tours. And I've had school groups come in, and the teachers made them memorize a speech, and you listen to them and they recite the speech to you. I think with foreign visitors to Gettysburg,
yes,
the Gettysburg Address is far more important, yes, and resonates more with them than the battle. They're not interested in the battle.
I have an experience there that I want to just get in. Eric, how many countries are we in right now? 100 and?
Well over 120.
So as most of you know, I'm not a full-time tour guide. I have another profession where I've spent most of my adult life. And in that occupation, I've worked with a lot of foreign nationals, foreigners, immigrants, people who come in. And without fail, when I tell them I live at Gettysburg, they know nothing about a battle. They know nothing about an American Civil War. Without fail, they always say, oh, Lincoln, you know, Gettysburg Address. Do you know where Lincoln gave the Gettysburg Address? Without fail. So you hit it right there on the head. For whatever reason, I think the address resonates much more with other countries than it's.
I've had two experiences. A number of years ago, I was able to go to Belgium and I visited Waterloo. And when I went to Wellington's headquarters, I said, hey, where are you from? I'm from Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. And the lady behind the desk said, oh, Gettysburg, Lincoln's speech.
Yep.
Nothing about Robert E. Lee, nothing about George Meade, nothing about a battle, Lincoln's speech. In fact, 2 weeks ago, I actually had two visitors on a tour. They were born and raised in South Korea. They were going to school about 10 years after the Korean War. And one of the things they had to learn in the sixth grade was the Gettysburg Address. Mm-hmm. And I think if you look at what was going on in Korean history at that time, they are learning how to be a democracy. They are learning, what does this mean? What better distillation of that than the 272 words here at Gettysburg?
Yeah. I think it does have more meaning, right or wrong, to other countries than it does here in the United States.
I think it overshadows the battle.
Oh, to them, it
definitely I think actually the Gettysburg Address is more well-known to the average person than the Battle of Gettysburg itself.
Yeah.
I mean, more people know 4 score and 7 years ago than they do July 1st, 2nd, or 3rd, 1863.
Right.
What a great opening, right? 4 score and 7. Why did he do that? Why did he pick 4 score? You know, that flips people out. Did you ever hear Bob Newhart? Bob Newhart had a record album when comedians had record albums, and he does a skit on the Gettysburg Address where he's Lincoln's campaign manager or speechwriter, and he's like, don't do that. Don't do that 4 score thing. No. But it is. You're right. I just love it. When I was a kid and I came to Gettysburg, and there was a time when I was a teenager and I drove to Gettysburg, dragged my little brother along, and I went into every single tourist attraction in the town. And maybe I did it all in one day. But do you know they've dropped the Gettysburg Address for most of the attractions? At the end of the cyclorama, they used to do the Gettysburg Address. And that was before the Richard Dreyfuss version. And at the end of the Charlie Weaver Museum, they did the Gettysburg Address. And at the end of the Wax Museum, the Gettysburg Address. So, and I'm sure I'm forgetting a few other attractions that did it. The Hall Presidents did the Gettysburg Address. So when I came and I did all those attractions, I heard the Gettysburg Address like five times that day. And it's something now in the new movie, we don't do the whole Gettysburg Address. We start it, we talk about it, we end it. But I guess people feel it's too long to deliver the whole thing.
2 minutes.
Yeah. I mean, if they think that's bad, listen to Everett, you know.
But I'm just enamored by it. In 1952, Gettysburg had a Mr. Lincoln to Gettysburg reenactment celebration, and they had an actor come, and he portrayed Abraham Lincoln, and he arrived by train, went to the Wills house, and great crowds followed him, went to the cemetery, and he did like a dramatization of Lincoln's visit. And they made postcards. It got a lot of attention in newspapers, but if you want to look into it, you can read about that, and there's a lot of in those newspaper articles, looking back at the Gettysburg Address and what it means to us. And it's really fascinating.
Well, before we run out of time, because we've kind of already covered some of the post-speech reactions and things like that. Again, common question for us battlefield guides when we're in and around the cemetery talking about the dress, where exactly did Lincoln stand? And there's been some recent theories about that. Do you have any opinions about where you think he stood? Does it matter, and any of that?
Yeah, I mean, early on, people thought that Lincoln gave the Gettysburg Address from a platform that was built where the Soldiers' National Monument is. And that had been the consensus that had been written about for many, many, many years. And I think it was the National Park Service Rangers, maybe Fred Tilburg and others, who tried to point out to people that, no, there was a flag there where the Soldiers National Cemetery was. But really, his platform was set up in what is now the Evergreen Cemetery. And we have photographs taken that day that are well known. And there are three angles that three different photographs are taken from. And you can triangulate those photographs and get a good idea of the platform being somewhere in this Evergreen Cemetery. And the fence between the two cemeteries did not exist. So he spoke to the crowd that was standing, in and amongst the graves of the Soldiers' National Cemetery. About a third of the soldiers had been buried at the time of the address, and the other two-thirds would be moved in later. In recent years, people have looked at this and analyzed it. William Frassinito analyzed it pretty well in his early photography, Gettysburg. He's basing his research on the photographs and where the Evergreen Cemetery plots were vacant at the time to allow you to put a platform that's like 20 feet long and 16 feet wide. Then, the new research that's done by him, or even, research like 10 years ago where somebody said they saw Lincoln riding in the crowd and it was publicized. Some of this, it seems to me it's just done to make a splash. Mm-hmm. With the recent guy saying the platform was not in the Evergreen Cemetery, I don't buy into his research, and I think I talked to him several times about it. A guy, his name is Christopher Oakley, and we talked about it like 4 years ago and to start off. And I think that when he did the research and figured out that the platform is about the same spot where we say it was, that it wasn't really dramatic and that he needed to say something dramatic. So it seems to me that his platform is moved slightly, so the front of the platform is in the National Cemetery, just so he can say, look, these guys are all wrong. He didn't speak from the Evergreen Cemetery. He was standing 2 feet inside what is now the National Cemetery. It just, I'm like, okay, well, back up a second here. So we said he gave the address somewhere in here. Now, granted, the platform is got, you know, is pretty big. And you're saying he spoke somewhere in here. How many feet different are we talking? Mm-hmm. It's not a New York Times article. It shouldn't, it's much about nothing to me. The place has dramatically changed since the time the address was given. So it looks a lot different. But I guess I still go along. Now, this is not based on the fact that I am a longtime former president of Evergreen Cemetery. But I still maintain that he gave the speech while he's standing on a platform in Evergreen Cemetery.
Evergreen Cemetery self-preservation, all the way since David McConaughey, folks. So, well, and I think this is a great example of, there seems to be every generation, you know, what is it, late 70s, early 80s, when really a lot of the ideas of using the photos coming in to kind of triangulate where it was, well, we're now almost a generation removed from that. It always seems that there's something that's kind of discovered a generation before that we just kind of go with, and then someone finds a new theory that really just kind of supports what we've already known, but you can't just say, I discovered 25 years later what they knew 25 years earlier. I think this is an example of that. And honestly, we're arguing over, what, 10, 15, 20 feet?
I think this was 20 yards. I think this one is 20 yards.
Well, it wouldn't be the first time that Gettysburg scholars argue over a yard here, a yard there. That never happens.
It's fine. So. It's fine.
Yeah.
All right, so anything to get Lincoln out of town?
Well, you know, of course, after the Gettysburg Address, Abraham Lincoln goes back down to the square, to the Wills House, and they have a luncheon. And what's really interesting is at some point, they open up the front door of the Wills House, they open up Wills Law Office, and they allow random people in a line to come through the house and meet all the dignitaries, the governors that assembled. And oh, when we were talking about politics earlier, I should mention that Horatio Seymour attended the ceremony. He was the highest ranking Democrat, the governor of New York, to attend Lincoln's Gettysburg Address. But they went through the Wills House. They shook hands with dignitaries. And, you know, this is, again, where a lot of local people say that Lincoln shook their hand or patted their head if they were a little boy or gave their mommy a kiss. That's right.
Yeah. Oh, he got that from Tad.
Of course, that is a very dramatic way that people like to end the Gettysburg Address story. That, you know, Lincoln's shaking all these hands. He's on the train ride back. He's a little bit tired. He feels sick. The next day, a doctor comes and visits him, and he has a slight case of smallpox. And I think it's his valet, William Johnson, I believe, that dies. But it's a while. It's a few weeks later. It might be like at the beginning of end of December, early January. He dies of smallpox. So, yeah, I wonder how locally that worked. You know, it was like a super spreader event.
Yeah.
Hey, I'm a little surprised you didn't mention church with John Burns.
Yeah. Well, you know, if you want me to get to that. So
short version.
So after the reception, the governors of Ohio asked David Wills if he knew where they could have an event. David Wills is a member of the Presbyterian Church. He gets in the Presbyterian Church. I say governors of Ohio. The state of Ohio sent their governor-elect, their current governor, and their former governor to the ceremony. So there were three Ohio governors at the ceremony, and the lieutenant governor-elect of Ohio, Charles Anderson, whose brother is Robert Anderson of Fort Sumter fame, gave a speech at the Presbyterian Church. And Abraham Lincoln walked outside to go to that ceremony. He had mentioned earlier to someone that he wanted to meet that John Burns had fought in the battle. So John Burns, he went down, got him, and he arrived just as Lincoln was getting ready to walk to the Presbyterian Church. So Lincoln invited him. He shook his hand in front of dozens of reporters, gave him the thanks of the nation, and I maintain that's why John Burns really got famous, that event. And then Lincoln and Burns walked to the Presbyterian Church where Charles Anderson gave the speech and John Burns fell asleep. And then about midway through the speech, Lincoln was informed his train was ready to go. He stood up and he walked down to the train station at about 7 p.m. He left the town. One thing's fascinating, let me mention this about the departure. They, at some point in the afternoon, they put the president's cars on the track at the station and hooked a locomotive up to it. No one was allowed to leave town by train until the president's train left. So after the address, all these people are just standing around, and apparently there's thousands of people standing at the train station waiting to go home, and no one can leave. And Lincoln is off at some political rally, you know, with John Burns. So I always wonder about what that looked like. And then, you know, after the president's train, I have tried to look into it, but I have very little insight in what the train yard looked like, or how many extra tracks we have, or how many locomotives are waiting, and how many cars are in town. We obviously have more than just a couple cars that are usually running on those tracks. There must be locomotives sitting on a sidetrack and cars waiting to go out of town afterwards. So it probably takes people a while to get their spot on the train and go after Lincoln.
So he's keeping people waiting, kills a couple with smallpox. Do we have any audience questions for Tim?
Okay, so the question was about Edward Everett's reaction to Abraham Lincoln. So I believe it's the National Archives or the Library of Congress website. You can actually look at this letter. So Edward Everett felt compelled to pen a note to Abraham Lincoln afterwards. And basically, I'll paraphrase it, but he said, I hope I can relish in the belief that I came as close to the central meaning of the ceremony in 2 hours as you did in 2 minutes. That's not a myth. He actually wrote that to Lincoln a couple days afterwards.
Isn't it the day after?
Yeah, is it the day after?
I think it's the day after he writes that,
so Edward Everett was very impressed.
Yeah.
So that's true. I mean, that's the thing, isn't it? That, you know, a lot of this stuff is true. It's just that there's the popular things, the myth intertwined to it, mm-hmm. always seem to get to us.
Yeah. Anything else?
Where's Elizabeth Thorne during the address?
Good question. I think I'm trying to think of her accounts, but I don't think that I have a single account by her.
Isn't there one where one of the kids? One of the kids in later years says, "Mom wanted to make sure that we saw the president." So I think they did see part of it.
Yeah. I wish in her account it had gotten into that a little more. But yeah, she must be there. Yeah, but I don't have any insight into that.
And just so our mics didn't pick up, the question was, where was Elizabeth Thorne during this? So when you listen to this in the future, it'll make more sense.
Yes, that's good. That's good.
Just keeping this thing running smoothly. It's all we can do.
And hey, we can't say it enough. We really appreciate all of your support. Eric and I, and then Jody joining the team in the last year or so. Podcasting in Gettysburg has been a surprisingly tumultuous experience at times, but we've persevered, and we're not only, you know, we should just give a quick shout out to Andrew Dalton, of course. And thank Tim once again for appearing. I don't know, does anybody got anything else?
I'm very happy to be here.
Should have something to just, we shouldn't just end on that.
Yeah, I know.
That's so anticlimactic.
Yeah.
And just echoing what Jim says, I want to thank everyone for attending, all your support. It's greatly appreciated by all of us. So once again, thank you for attending. This has been the Battle of Gettysburg podcast.
Take care, folks. All right. Woo!